I wanted to say I'm Chris Sharon, and I'm here this summer with my wife Sonia helping coordinate the teaching staff. And the very first thing I wrote and published was a book called Married in the Sight of God, which I wrote when I was in seminary in Berkeley. And Ev Kalin, actually, right, who's one of my professors at the time. It's nice to have you here, Ev.
Thank you.
Anyway, I got into this subject out of anger. Anger over what was happening to friends of mine in seminary. And so I wrote this book detailing some of the background of the ELCA struggles over the issue of homosexuality. And it's, I don't know, probably $29 or $30 in the bookstore, so $250 starts to look pretty good when you compare it to
this. What did you say the name is?
Married in the Sight of God. It's a quote from Luther. Not talking necessarily about what I was talking about. But thanks for coming. And what I'd like to do is run through a presentation of some framing comments that will, I hope, help us in engaging what the task force has put together and presented to the church, and feed into a conversation with one another about issues that the topic in general and the way our church is and has been grappling with it. And when Mark Twain came in, he said, "Is that really the title of the church's statement?" And I said, "We have never yet embraced that kind of boldness as the Lutheran Church talking about sexuality. Would that we could." Anyway, we'll try and be serious in grappling with the serious topic, a topic that, in one way or another, cuts through all of our lives, offering joy and pain. But also, at appropriate moments, realize the levity of the whole thing, too. One of my favorite writings on Christianity and sexuality is by Rowan Williams, and it's a short article called The Body's Grace. And in that article, one of the things he says is sexuality is just hopelessly hilarious. There's no way to master it. It makes fools of all of us. Especially when we, as a 5 million member denomination, try and write a social statement about it. Well, see if my flippy-doo works. Yeah, it does. So just very quickly, some historical background. We've been working at this effort to do a social statement for quite a while. The whole 1960s was taken up with, for the LCA, in trying to come up with a social statement, and boy did they have a hard time. So if we think we're having a tough time, nothing new under the sun. It took them a decade of fighting to come up with sex, marriage, and the family. And my teacher Marty Stortz at our seminary in Berkeley always laughed at that statement, thinking after all that wrangling, how did they end up with that order in the title? Makes you wonder. I don't think I have the title right for the ALC statement, but it was something like the church and human sex, something much more prosaic than the LCA statement. But anyway, each of the of those two of the three predecessor bodies struggled over a decade or more and came up with social statements. Which in fact still to this day serve as guiding documents for the ELCA because we haven't officially adopted our own social statement on sexuality. So in 1988 the ELCA begins, and there's a lot more history I could go into here, and I have in the Married in the Sight of God book, but in response to a number of issues that developed early on, Karen Bloomquist tried to lead the studies department in developing a social statement on sexuality, the church and human sexuality. And unfortunately, it was released before it was to the press, before it was sent out to congregations. And so headlines appeared across the country, ELCA approves masturbation, and so on. And it created such a stir that unfortunately it had significant adverse consequences for Karen's role in the studies department, and created a quick withdrawal of that draft, and then a second draft in a brown cover that made sure you knew it was tentative, a draft study toward a social statement on human sexuality, which didn't in the end lead anywhere. But anyway, that happened in the 90s. Then the 2001 ELCA Churchwide Assembly called for a process that would inform the church about especially issues of blessing of same-sex unions and ordination of people in same-sex unions. And that had a number of stages as they put it together. Jim Childs was the original leader of the project, and they called it Journey Together Faithfully. And the first effort was a message on sexuality, trying to just say we agree on something. Sexual exploitation is wrong. Rape is wrong. So it wasn't exactly the most robust statement, but nonetheless, they tried to say a few things that we all agree on as a first step, drawing on predecessor statements. Then, in 2005, a long study, in a sense, trying to present, I think, trying to present the fact that the ELCA isn't of one mind on the issue. So there's a lot of on the one hand, on the other hand, in that document. And it was intended to encourage a lot of conversation. Some people hoped they would come with specific recommendations for change in the church, which didn't, in fact, happen. And then the final piece in the progress of this decade-long process for the 2000s is the draft social statement on human sexuality as a whole. And that's what we have before us now. Hans, you got to back up just a little bit so I can get my flippy-doo going. There we go. Thank you. I'll try and put it out here so you can record my mind. So what's at stake at the moment is this group that drafted the social statement is supposed to bring after revisions based on the responses of people like you and me over the next months, bring a revised social statement to the 2009 Churchwide Assembly in Minneapolis, as well as recommendations to the Church Council on blessing of same-sex unions and ordination of those in such unions. So there's sort of two aspects of what will come out of this moment's sort of task force work headed toward the Churchwide Assembly. If you haven't seen it, this is, how many of you haven't seen it yet? Okay, this is the table of contents. Introduction, theological and ethical foundations, sexuality as part of God's creative activity, trust at the heart of faith, active in love, and social trust in the common good. And, you know, buy it, read it, download it off the internet for free. Look through it. I'm not going to go through it part by part in a summary fashion. What I'm going to do is try and present a framework for thinking about what's going on in the document. And I'm going to start by looking at two early critiques that came out after it was released in March. The first is from Robert Benny, who's traditionally upholding a conservative or traditionalist position on these issues. He teaches ethics at, Roanoke College, an ELCA college in Virginia. And his ethics for Teletubbies really try, in a goofy, I think, sort of way, tries to say the statement has no definition, it has no form. That it recommends. And he says the fatal flaw of the statement is it doesn't affirm definite forms, definite norms or principles that would guide Christian sexual morality. So he thinks it's weak in its use of commandments and law and rules. So you can hear in the background of that kind of concern, someone who wants to have clear guidelines that says what we should do and what we shouldn't do, who's able to do what, where, when, and why. And he published this in First Things, a journal which I think is a very thoughtful journal, very intellectual journal about church and society, but which under its editor, Richard John Newhouse, tends toward the traditionalist side of things. The second early critique was from Lutherans Concerned North America, which in its sort of title calls for the recognition of LGBT families. And they said they have substantial disagreement with the draft statement over how it continues to discriminate against same-gender couples by expecting the same ethical standards as heterosexual couples without the same support and benefits. So I thought it was interesting that both of the critiques from the left and the right, if you will, appeal to principle as the key in their critique. Benny, on the one hand, appealing to biblical norms and principles, and LCNA appealing to political norms of equity and justice as their angle of critique in addressing it. So, what I want to do is, have any of you ever heard methodological throat clearing as a phrase? It can't go on too long or you lose your audience, but sometimes it helps you speak more clearly. And so I want to just pause for a little methodological reflection before we go in and look at the draft statement, because I think it puts the early critiques in some perspective and helps us be better readers of what the authors of the statement have done. And I'm drawing this methodological reflection from one of my teachers in Christian ethics, Jim Gustafson, who in the 60s complained in an article called The Misplaced Debate Between Context and Principle that the polemics in Christian ethics really didn't amount to much. They were in a sense, polarizing unnecessarily and not really looking at the full range of issues that need to be considered when you're criticizing someone's position. So he said the people who based their argument on norms or principles were criticizing contextual ethics, people who said, well, you really have to understand the person or the situation in order to know how to respond. And those people who were contextualists were saying, well, how can principles apply? They're too idealist, they're too rigid to make sense in a particular person's life or a particular situation. And he said, no, actually, to have a Christian ethic that makes full sense of our life together, we have to have four aspects. And anybody's position needs to think these through, whether you start with the situation or whether you start with principle. So these are the four: situational analysis, theological affirmation, moral principles, and the nature of self in Christian life. So let's look at a couple examples just to make more sense of this. Paul Ramsey was an ethicist who tended to lead with moral principles, and he wrote powerfully about just war. And so, for instance, he would start with the principle of non-combatant immunity. People who aren't combatants shouldn't be attacked, shouldn't be targeted, as a principle for thinking about just war. But then, in order to unpack that some, he has to move to the next step, which is thinking about the contemporary context of warfare, which isn't simply to, like if you saw the first film version of the Chronicles of Narnia, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. At the end, there are these two great armies that come out onto a big open grassy field and attack one another. Well, it's pretty hard to hit non-combatants when everyone on the field is a combatant. But if you're flying over a city like they did in World War II, bombing London, how do you differentiate? You have to sort of say, well, the whole country is a combatant. So he had to think through the contemporary context, the situation we're in relationship to that principle. Then, what's the justification for arguing that principle is important in the first place, from God's perspective, theologically speaking? And he said, well, the call of love is to defend the neighbor. You're called to love God and love the neighbor. And one of the ways he argued you love the neighbor is by protecting those who are not combatants. So he justifies the principle by an appeal to theology. And then fourth, he describes how the individual lives a Christian life. And he says the first fact of our lives is that we live in response to God. And so even if the principle is what we normally follow, we have to be open to the fact that God may call us differently. So he, in fact, even though he starts with principle, covers all four of the bases. I'll go through this more quickly. This is an alternative example from Joseph Sittler, who was viewed more as a contextual ethicist instead of a principle-based ethicist. He would start saying, well, the Christian life is lived out of what Christ has done for us, justifying us as sinners by grace through faith. And so we live our lives out of that pattern of God's self-giving action for us. And this Christ-shaped life is always lived in particular contexts. So there's a contextual element at the heart of it because of the theological affirmation and the understanding of the self. And so when he gets to principles, he says, well, there is a principle of love animating this proposal, but it's never codified. It's just a sort of undergirding energy as a part of it. So very different, but they each talk about all four of the pieces. One of the payoffs in doing this is saying, leave aside the polemics. We all, whatever we're starting from, however we're coming to the debate, need to attend to these. And if we want to criticize how someone else has done it, we have to attend to all of them and not just say, oh, well, they used principles wrong. We have to ask, how do they derive the principles and how do they use them in relationship to how I would argue? So it adds, I think, an element of calm and reason into the conversation that often is missing when people are fighting back and forth across the so-called culture wars. So with that framework in mind, let's turn to the ELCA social statement on human sexuality. This is what I just said, basically. So what I want to do is look, instead of looking through the draft according to its table of contents, look through the draft and see what does it say on each of these four bases for a full theological ethic. How does the draft statement, use moral principles? Benny says the draft has a vacuous notion of law and discounts commandments. And Lutherans Concerned North America says the draft uses doublespeak, contributing to injustice along the way. But the draft opens the very first sentence with a discussion of Matthew 22:36 through, oh, I have 36 through 30, that's interesting. Ever read the Bible backwards? But it's basically the command to love God and love the neighbor as yourself, as the way to fulfill the law. So it starts right out defining a particular way of understanding God's law. And it's a way to understand the law that neither simply looks back to the letter of the law at some point in the history of Israel or the church and says, this is what we do. It looks at how Jesus reinterpreted and focused the obedience to the law and the commandment to love. And it also goes deeper than legal conceptions of justice as fairness. It's not that we have all equal rights, but that we're called to this servant love, which is somehow different and a more powerful, I think, understanding of what's owed to the other than simply a political conception of justice as fairness. So it moves on from that way of thinking about law. And by the way, there's 50-some references to law in the draft statement, so I hardly think it's legitimate to say that the statement doesn't deal with law. It just doesn't deal with law in the way that, say, Robert Benny would most appreciate. So it begins with a double command to love God and the neighbor, and that signals a theological commitment to begin with what God has done in Christ. So it starts with incarnation. Incarnation is the way God acted toward the world. The giving up of divinity and becoming human for the sake of the world. And so the statement, as you read through it, affirm, profoundly affirms materiality, material creation, the body, and all that that means, both personally and socially. And it sets up the focus on the importance of contextual freedom. If really what we're talking about in Christian faith is God made flesh and lived out in the context of relationships and culture, then context is going to be very important. So, the draft, as you read through it, has, I think, a real sensitivity to the cultural upheaval. It starts right on the first page talking about 60 to 70 years of cultural change and almost a snowballing of questioning about traditional views of sexuality, gaining speed through the 60s into the 70s. And so it says complexity is central to how we approach these questions. Everything, in a sense, is contested right now, and we have to have that as a part of our consideration of the context. Then, partly in response to that, the draft does a careful phenomenology of sexuality and relationships. What does that mean, if phenomenology isn't a word that you use at coffee hour? Just a careful attending to and describing of how we live with one another. What's the character of our life together? So it doesn't necessarily just spend the whole draft exegeting the Bible or exegeting what Thomas Aquinas or another theologian, Martin Luther, might say about sexuality, but how actually do we experience relationship and the kinds of complexity that people face in their lives? And the reason I think they spend so much time on that in the draft is because of their claim that our context is a context of upheaval. Then, perhaps most importantly of all their ways of addressing these points, instead of seeing humans, the self and the Christian life as obeying principles woodenly, like you're a puppet and the marionette God is saying, do this, do that, or in a sense doing whatever, oh, I feel like, you know, I'm married, but I feel like going out with that person tonight, or whatever. In a kind of no law matters to me. The draft portrays us as trusting people. That as Christians, the fundamental reality that defines who we are is trust. And they draw this, I think, in part from Luther's explanation of the first commandment, in which he says, you're supposed to love, trust, and fear God. That's the very first and most important thing we do in relationship to God. And then he goes on to say, whatever you trust, whatever you place your trust in, there I will show you your God. So he thinks, Martin Luther thinks of our sort of core human sensibility in our lives as related to trust. And so our basic trusting relationship is in relationship to God and the promises made in Christ. But that faithfulness, if you think in a sense of that as a vertical faithfulness, is also then the model for and the requirement of our horizontal relationships with one another, a kind of basis for trust and trustworthiness in social relationships. So then the draft articulates, out of that basic view of what human life is about, all kinds of relationships and the things that make for and break trusting relationships. So, putting it together, we ourselves who trust in God and seek to trust and be trustworthy toward one another. This key view of the self in Christian life helps us face a dramatically challenging and complex age, especially when we seek to consider that the trust we seek to offer to others is the same trust we place in God, who in Christ is reconciling all things. This is a theological framework with which to consider particular questions like, should you have sex before marriage? Should you have sex in marriage? Should you have sex before marriage with the person you're planning to marry? Should GLBT people be able to have relationships that are encouraged and even blessed by the church? All these questions are particular questions that can be answered out of this theological framework that the document is proposing for the church's reflection on sexuality. So, I think in the main, that's a very generative and helpful theological framing of how Lutherans come to deal with social questions. And then, part of what I want to raise now is, how does that play out when the statement actually does move to dealing with specific questions? I think the focus on trust is helpful in thinking about sex outside of marriage. Not when you're married having sex outside of marriage, but in other words, if you're single, whether or not to have sex. So they talk about trust for this reason, because our lives are built in these networks of trust. For this reason, this church teaches that degrees of physical intimacy should be carefully matched to degrees of affection and commitment. So that's a really different thing than I've heard said in other social statements. And it offers a way to think much more constructively about the real experience of sexuality of many people, especially the emerging adulthood demographic, who are delaying marriage up into the early 30s and dealing with maybe 15 years or even 20 years after the onset of puberty before they decide to commit to marriage. So what do we say to that emerging adulthood demographic, or to any single person? Well, that's, I think, a much more helpful sound basis for some real conversations about what kinds of risks and trust are required for the beauty and the joy and the power and the risk and vulnerability of intimacy. It goes where you would expect it to go, which is to say the most intimate sexual relationship should be reserved for the highest level of committed relationship. Not surprising. The draft turns to form, and I'll say what I mean by that, to limit possible implications of the generative theological frame I've been outlining. So if you just ignore the first sentence and read from here down and read the quote that they broke out, you think, wow, you know, that's a really compelling understanding of relationships of the sort that are between two committed people. It could be two women, could be two men, could be a man and a woman. But the whole thing is structured by the insertion of the first sentence about how social statements in the Lutheran Church over the last 50 years have described marriage, a structure of mutual promises between a man and a woman blessed by God. Well, even the Bible has a whole range of ways that marriage has been socially structured, not just that one. And we keep reiterating that as if over the course of history, there weren't diverse models of how marriage was configured, and now a really significant debate about that exact question. So this is a place where I feel like, for whatever reason, some of the members on the task force felt like they couldn't fully say what the implications of the theological framework might make possible. And you can see the tension even in this paragraph, I think. And here, I would say, though the draft has resources for a faithful theology of same-sex marriage, it freezes again. It freezes in the sense that Deanne Lagerquist was talking about last night. That there's a way that sometimes under threat, in a context of fear, instead of thinking afresh, finding God's living word for today, the church takes a theological concept out of the freezer and defrosts it, and just lets it stand for now. When it was a way of thinking and arguing developed in another time. So you read through this, and it basically just says, geez, we're really confused. We've been talking a lot about this, but then this church recognizes marriage as a lifelong committed relationship between a man and a woman and does not wish to alter this understanding. Even though all this complexity is happening in the states. The states are struggling with this, and some states are creating legal structures for same-sex unions, and some states, Massachusetts and now California, have passed laws that allow same-sex marriage. marriage equality. So here, even more tension, I think, than you see when they're dealing with the marriage section, and those two are related. So as a concluding point, before we enter into some more conversation together, I wanted to recall Fred Geiser's session this morning about Isaiah 56 and the eunuchs, who were excluded from participation in the congregation, in the Torah. And then, returning from exile, Isaiah boldly declares a new word from the Lord, that those eunuchs and foreigners who seek the Lord and wish to be a part of the congregation are welcome. And there's this kind of powerful, mind-blowing declaration that the Lord's house is a house of prayer for all people. A piece of Isaiah which Jesus picks up and declares himself when he's cleansing the temple. So, seeking a new word for the Lord is something that Fred has put before the church in the article he wrote in Word and World, and I think it's an important question for us to grapple with. What does it mean as we look at this statement in particular, and as we address these broader questions in general, to answer this question about seeking a new word from the Lord? So, at this point, I'll stop and just sort of moderate a little bit and try and encourage as many people who have questions and comments and thoughts, responses to the draft, to jump in. I'm an introvert, so I'm okay with silence.
Well, I was just going to say, can you move back one frame?
Sure.
So that we, as we consider what we're thinking, we're doing so from that final statement you had.
Sure. This one?
Yeah. I kind of like from 51 on, from the basis that the church can decide how it feels, but the people outside of the church without cause to fuss within the church can make their description. It's the best I've seen so far.
51 through 55.
It says the church recognizes the historic origin of the term marriage. Then it goes on, it recognizes, however, that some states have enacted in, or are in the process of enacting legislation in which the term marriage is used.
Here's my frustration with this. The church, this church, does not wish to alter this. I mean, that's just a lie. Because if the church is the assembly of believers gathered around the gospel rightly preached and the sacraments rightly administered, then this church is fighting like hell about whether we ought to continue this.
Yeah, it does not wish, but that is not restricting somebody who may desire so. Does it?
Outside the church.
Does not wish to alter this understanding as the church understands marriage.
Yep.
So what I don't necessarily think that that's, like, I know people that I respect who think that, but our social statement, if it's going to represent our church, needs to be more honest about the struggle and the reasons for contesting what that says. So this is what I'm trying to point out, that at certain points the statement seems to cut off argument when in fact the church, this church, is engaging in quite vital
debate. Wishy-washy then?
What's that?
Wouldn't you call that wishy-washy?
Well,
I have a question.
That's a good question. Would it be wishy-washy? Well, I think actually a lot of our social statements represent wishy-washy thinking. And so it is a challenge to speak clearly when the church is in a big debate about it. You and then, tell me your name.
Karen.
Karen. And
so,
then
you know, I understand where you're coming from, and so if it, if this is made not wishy-washy, then the people who make up the church that do wish to alter this understanding, does this mean that they are should no longer be part of the church then?
Yeah, that's
because
a good question.
Because they no longer have the option to try to alter it.
Good question. Can people hear that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I didn't follow it.
Well, this statement says, this church does not wish to alter this understanding. So those in this church, who might wish to alter it, does this statement mean they no longer have a place in this church? In other words, this sentence is saying this church is within this circle of understanding, so if you're not within that circle of understanding, are you cut out because of the way it's written? That's what you're raising, yeah.
Go.
I had a couple thoughts, but my first one is just that my issue with that sentence actually starts earlier in the sentence, which is, this church recognizes the historic origin of the term marriage. And I don't think this document ever unpacks the historic origins or what marriage has been throughout history,
right.
And I think that's very, very dangerous,
right,
to say what's been said earlier on with the scripture citation of marriage between a man and a woman. And then to reiterate that here, and I think that's the only, if I remember correctly, those are the only times in the document really does the marriage man.
That's right. These are the two spots where,
right,
where that one sentence definition of marriage with a little bit different language,
right,
is there.
And so I agree completely with you in that it's not a true statement later on in the document when it says we don't wish to alter our self-understanding. The honest thing is to say what they say earlier on in the section, I think, about same-gender relationships, which is the churches does not have consensus.
Right.
That frustrates the crap out of me, but at least it's true. I'm much more frustrated with the document saying something that isn't true, which is that the church doesn't wish to alter its understanding. The church doesn't know what it wants.
Yeah.
But in any case, the thing I wanted to bring up is that this idea of the historic understanding of marriage, I don't feel like it's treated well in the document. It worries me.
One of the things that Mark Jordan has raised, he's a gay Catholic scholar at Emory University, where I did my doctoral work. One of the things he raises about the raising of the question of the possibility of gay marriage is that it forces a much more significant evaluation of heterosexual marriage. And one of the things then that we begin to realize is it's not been nearly such a tidy institution as we sometimes claim. Yeah.
Yeah, I kind of want to go back to her comment, maybe flip to the next slide, about how when we say this church says this or this church says that, and if we make a definite statement, does that exclude other people?
Yeah.
And I really totally agree with that, and I think it kind of brings up the question, well, how do we even write these social statements? I mean, anytime you say this church says something, the reality is that you almost all the time, 100% of the people who consider themselves a part of this church might not agree with that.
Right.
And so every time you make a statement, you are excluding someone. And I think it's a little bit frustrating, because if you were to write something that was literally true, the entire document would be, this church does not have consensus on this issue, or this issue, or this issue, or that issue. So I think the question for me, and I don't know the answer, is what are we really trying to do here,
yeah,
with a social statement?
Well, let me say very briefly what social statements do. Number one, they're policy documents for the ELCA. So whatever is approved by the churchwide assembly, which is in a sense the gathering of the whole church in delegate form, whatever they vote for becomes policy for the ELCA in its own work. And it also then is used on the basis of, as a sort of encouragement for study and reflection on the part of our members and those in the wider church and world. So it has two functions, and I think the policy function is part of the reason why there's such contention over how this turns out, because it could either continue the current policy of the ELCA or overturn it, depending on the direction that it goes. But, like you said, it doesn't necessarily find agreement in all quarters, so there's a lot of language in the ELCA about being a community of moral deliberation. If we're really a lively tradition, it means that there's an argument going on. And so social statements, in part, are supposed to serve our debate with one another and not necessarily solve the the issue. So a couple of the things I think that, let's go back here for a couple people. Well, I'm sorry, we'll come back to you, but back in this corner, yeah.
If the statement of the church recognizing the historic term for marriage is passed, what happens to the second sentence? Other pastors and congregations will call our same gendered orientation brothers, et cetera, and sisters, et cetera. What's going to happen to them?
Back on this one?
No,
the right at the top.
Here, first paragraph. At the top.
If the ELCA decides they're not going to change, to alter the understanding of historic term for marriage, right, then what happens to the pastors and congregations, some of which are currently following that, the rest of that first paragraph?
Anyone else can answer that too, but my opinion is we're already there. Right now, we have...
The same thing is going to be happening to these folks.
We'll just continue to do what we're doing now, which is we have, in a sense, an official order or policy in the church, and then dissenting views, which have been lived into for decades. And so it's almost as if there's multiple tracks. And the hoped for new way of living together is already being lived together in many communities and by many couples. So I see that as a great sign of hope, but huge frustration. Because at the same time as that's happening, it's also not officially recognized in a part of the church's life. So there's going to be a lot of frustration, but I don't think the actual configuration will change. People will struggle the way they are now. Other comments in response to her before we move? Up here?
Yeah. Back to what Andrew was saying earlier, too. This is incredibly frustrating. I mean, that seems like a fact. And so the ELCA is either going to have a decision just to keep kind of BSing their way and not really take a stance, or like, what is the probability? It seems like when they do take a stance, and you are going to have such a divided community, some are going to agree with it and some are not, isn't there just going to eventually becoming a schism one way or another, and the ELCA is going to have to break off, and there's going to be something else come up, whichever group disagrees with whatever stance the ELCA takes? And doesn't that seem like it's just going to happen?
What do you think?
I think it's got to. I mean,
how bad do you think the divide would be?
Well, it seems very divided. You've got, you know, a school of thought where it says this is morally based. It's to a degree where some people don't even accept, gays or transgender as even people.
Right.
And then you've got the others that see to such an extent that they need all rights and it's not even a question,
right,
otherwise. And it's just such a wide spectrum that I don't see how they can avoid a schism one way or another.
Part of my, if I was going to guess, part of what I think's been happening is stalling. So that when a decision is finally made, the impact on the group that will leave will be minimized. Smaller number of people will leave.
But how long can you stall? I mean, that's,
yeah, exactly. I'm not saying I agree with the stalling tactic,
yeah,
but sometimes that's my Machiavellian.
Well, it's definitely what's going on here.
Description.
So the ALC was much more grassroots,
uh-huh,
I thought, and the LCA was much more top-down.
Yeah.
And some people have claimed that the ELCA was not a merger but a hostile takeover.
Yeah.
But I don't want to go there. Do you see that a possibility here that the autonomy of the local congregation could become much stronger, so that congregations who disagree with any statement that they finally come up with, as well as congregations that agree with it, could live together? Or isn't that a possibility? I mean, because right now I think I in the local congregation, one of the things they're struggling with is the autonomy of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we stand in terms of our own authority,
yeah,
especially when 1,000 people, maybe that, you know, whatever decision you make.
Yeah.
It's, I'm really asking a bureaucratic question.
Yeah. I mean, again, I don't know the answer to that, but I would say, in fact, part of what I see happening is a congregational response. And I was talking to Alan Hilton about the UCC, and he said he thinks the fact that they have a congregational polity has really aided their ability to have the openness that they do have. And there are other reasons too, but. So like my former congregation in Atlanta, St. John's, Bradley Schmeling is the pastor there, and he just went through a really wrenching trial and was removed from the roster. And so that congregation was faced with really a congregational question. Do we feel like Bradley is our pastor, that he's doing what the confessions called the pastor to do faithfully in his place? And they said yes, and so they asked him to stay. And so then it ends up being a de facto congregationalism in the vehicle of their dissent. Other people, yeah.
Okay. Make sure that people know about the DVD, CD, whatever it is, of his congregation. It's fantastic viewing. But my point that I want to make...
Of St. John's?
Yes.
I don't know.
He came to Pullman, Washington, about a month or so ago.
Okay.
Fantastic.
Soon coming to Holden Village Bible Study, Bradley Schmeling, later in July. Hope you're staying.
No, I won't. I can't. Historic origin, revisited again. Which historic origin are they talking about? I was thinking of luminous property.
Yeah, right.
How many women in this room had the pastor say, "Who giveth this woman to be married to this man?"
Yeah. Yeah.
Luminous property is our historic origin, not this.
Yeah.
I don't think that my wife wants to go back to...
Well, this is really interesting because... This is really interesting. When in the 50s, the Harold Haas invoked the language of the heterosexual structure of creation in a little booklet on marriage, he was doing it in order to keep women at home and men at work, and women out of control and men in control. And that language, by the early 1960s, became flipped and was used to keep gays in their place and straight people in power. So that language, similar to what you're saying, shifts in its use, but it ends up being, like in this sentence, a rhetorical tool to sort of slip past some really complicated history in order to make a point. I think that's helpful.
What's not being said is for some of us who are pastors who have done... One of the pastoral friends who's here, he says, "I just get so tired of being a pimp for the state, for doing weddings."
Yeah.
And he says, "Let's divide them and get them apart." So he said, "If they want to go to the justice of the peace and get a license,
right,
fine.
Right.
If they want to have a blessing from their religious community decide, what do we call it?"
Right. People are doing that on principle. I've talked to a number of people who've stopped
doing it. People have been
doing
it in Europe for quite a long time.
Yeah. Anybody else up here? I'm missing Fred.
With regard to what was just been said here about the historic origin, one of my colleagues, facetiously but not altogether incorrectly, says, "You know, what does the Bible say about marriage? You don't want to know." But other than that, the issue of where are we now? I'd be a little less Machiavellian, Chris, about this at the present time as merely stalling. To be sure, that probably is true for some. At the end of my article, as I did this morning, I suggested that it was not immediately obvious when Isaiah, third Isaiah, whatever his name was, got up and said, "Thus says the Lord."
Yeah.
This was not canonized that afternoon.
Right.
It took a long time for the people of God to come to terms with the reality that altogether striking, audacious statement was in fact the Word of God.
Right.
A time of sifting and waiting and prayer. And that's sort of what I say at the end of my article too, that we need that perhaps we need some time of sifting and waiting and prayer.
Yeah.
That's, as everybody has said here, frustrating, and it's frustrating for people on both sides of the argument. We just want them out of here, or we just want to make it clear that we belong here. It's frustrating for both sides. But it's sort of the way the canonization process works.
Right.
A frustrating period of waiting for the certainty of the Spirit to know which way to go. Now, I don't know how long you wait, at least to some degree, it seems to me that's what the present is, rather than merely a stalling tactic.
Yeah. I mean, I really appreciate that. And I think I mean Machiavellian in the sense of strategic thinking.
Yeah, okay.
I think on the part of some people, the unity of the church is so important that that strategically what they'd like is to buy more time before we come up with the decision so that some of this marinating in the debates can happen with the hope that more people will have the opportunity to come to their own conclusion. And it's really fascinating in the sexuality, the homosexuality study that came out in 2005, they had a statistical breakdown in the back of all the respondents. And if you break it down by age group, it's just total, I don't know, maybe it's not totally predictable, but the youngest group has the highest support for this change on homosexuality, and the oldest demographic has the lowest support. So there's just a direct line of shift as you go younger in age.
The question of the unity of the church, and as you've been discussing that, I mean, this church does not wish. Which church? And what does that mean of whose church? And surprisingly, for as many of you know, Wolfhard Pannenberg, who normally is regarded as a rather progressive theologian, essentially does turn that thing into a status confessionis, a church that blesses same-sex unions, but then you can call itself Christian. I mean, that is the question. Do we want to make this thing status confessionis? That is one side or the other. This is the state of the confession of the church, and you're either with us or against us. And there are those who in person certainly had say and do that, as we all know. I mean, we all know people, like I presume, who say if it goes X, I'm out of here, and other people who say if it goes Y, I'm out of here, which is to say that they, in their person, have made it status confessionis for reasons that perhaps one can understand. Does the church want to make it status confessionis? That I would like to see that discussion, which isn't in here. Where do we regard this issue in terms of the central confessions of the church, and how far away do you have to be from the central confessions of the church in order to make it a live or die issue for the church and for individual members of the church?
Mark.
I just think it's important to get that kind of nuance into the conversation that we just then offered here. I mean, there's a sense in which, and I would be among those who think that what justice calls for is a kind of full inclusion and full ordination of gay and lesbian people, and that is a value I would fight for and seek to promote. It's not the only value, however. It seems to me church unity is another value. So that one has to see, as our greatest political leader in history, Abraham Lincoln, did, that however evil slavery was, preserving the Union was also important. And Lincoln's whole endeavor was to somehow find a way both to see to it that slavery was on the course of ultimate extinction and that the Union be preserved. And he sought, I think in a non-Machiavellian way, to keep those two values in some kind of, hopefully both could be realized, even if it meant a certain postponement of immediate emancipation, which is what the abolitionists called for, and certainly had the high moral ground there, in that slavery is kind of prima facie, great iniquity. And we have a similar situation, it seems to me, the church is facing, and we need a kind of prudent leadership that takes due account of the moral gravity of the situation we're in terms of what we've done historically with gay and lesbian people, but on the other hand, that there is a certain virtue in maintaining the kind of church we've come to inherit and love. And it seems to me reasonable people have a lot of room for reasonable disagreement of exactly how to negotiate and work out this whole complicated agenda. And we should somehow refrain from being too quick to accuse those on the other side, that is, who want to be more deliberative and delay, as being whatever, Machiavellian or merely strategic or whatnot, they could well be Lincoln-esque in trying, and of course, we came to Civil War, so this whole strategy didn't work. But the point is, even Lincoln, when faced with the whole question, a bunch of ministers came to him and said, look, you've got to free the slaves. And Lincoln wanted to hold the border states. And the minister said, you've got to free the slaves now because God is on our side. And Lincoln's response in this apocryphal story was, it would be very well to have God on our side, but we must have Kentucky. In other words, there was a kind of strategic thinking as how you're going to preserve the Union even as you free the slaves, as he did, at a time when he could hold some of those loyalties. So what I'm saying is it's a very complicated situation, both from the biblical perspective that we just heard, and from the larger ecclesiological and political perspective. And all I'm calling for is people be aware of all those nuances and refrain from stereotyping people as simply being on one side or the other. There are multiple sides in this issue.
And I actually think, in the service of that kind of hanging in there, in the balance, statements like this need to be more honest.
I agree. So, I think that statement you pointed to is a bad statement. So,
thank you. Yeah, and then we'll go across this way.
I guess I would like to say essentially the same thing that was just said, except provide another context for thinking about it. I too long for and am working for a full inclusion of gay and lesbian people in the full ministry of the church and of its life. And I also see the radical significance of the unity of the church. And I think one of the places to think deeply about how we think of one another across lines is found in Romans 14:1 to 15:13, where people radically disagree about how you worship and live faithfully. And the key to that whole thing is welcome one another, but not for quarreling over opinions, as though you first have to solve everything before you can be one. And the welcoming is radical and a call not to judge others. I'd invite people to read that with this issue in mind, and to recognize the radicality of what Romans as a document is trying to do, to get people who had come to be in authority and power in the church not to write off other people. It really speaks to what we're thinking about. Yeah.
Thank you. We have 4:15 or 5:15, which is an hour, and this obviously has been going on for decades, so an hour is not nearly sufficient. But a concluding reflection for me about part of the reason why I think such powerful impatience for the unity question sits in a lot of people's hearts. And that is because I think the crux of the issue really is whether or not you view homosexual orientation as disordered or a part of the good creation. And how you fall on that question unfolds a whole set of other arguments. And it makes it really hard to swallow if you're on one side to say, okay, they think I'm disordered, or they think maybe even I'm an abomination. And that the level of the claim at the heart of this debate, I think, makes patience and goodwill as hard as it gets. I mean, as hard as it probably was in terms of slavery. And as hard as it was at certain points for men and women, when women really were considered less than human. So it's that, I think it's that kind of deep personhood question that arises such emotion. And that question, I don't think the draft ever really addresses straight on. And I regret that, because I think it's a crux issue that we really have to face. Thank you all for coming and for your comments and all the thoughts that you didn't get a chance to say. Yeah, Tom.
Just one quick informational piece that you may not all know about. The church is soliciting your opinion on this subject. And the comment period runs until, I think it's November.
November 1st.
November 1st.
In the back of the statement, there's a form you can fill out.
Right. And you'll find information posted in the dining hall about the synod. The live conferences that you can attend within all of the synods of the PLCA. So, like my father used to say, speak up or sleep in the street.
Thanks, everybody.
Speak up or sleep in the street.